Welcome back, everybody. Hello. We're glad to have you back today.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're going to start today by giving a shout out to our listeners. The majority of our downloads come from locations we can't identify. Those we can identify, thank you. Our top download locations are from our hometown and our neighboring town. So thank you very much.
Yeah, that makes me feel so, it makes me smile big time. So thank you, hometown people. We really appreciate your support. Some other top download locations are Cabot in Arkansas, which is close, which is kind of close to us. Indianapolis, I was shocked by that. Way to go. I've never been to Indianapolis, but I'd love to go. Chicago. Marion, which I'm assuming it's Marion, Arkansas. On our locations, they give us the cities, but not the state names. So
I'm assuming
a Marion, Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And Boardman, which I looked on the map and I think that's Boardman, Ohio. But if you're Boardman somewhere else, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's to give a very special shout out to a very special listener in Lindale, Texas. So we just really appreciate you guys listening and sharing. And today's episode is going to be one of those that you will want to share with the masses.
Absolutely. We have our friend, our amazing friend, Lindsay Kane back. She's come back to join us for another episode today. Thank you, Lindsay. Lindsay shared neurodiversity affirming practices in our classroom on our last episode. If you haven't had a chance to listen, we encourage you to do that, download that, because she gave us some great information. I learned a lot.
Mm-hmm, me too. Thought so much. So today is all about meltdowns. Is this a conversation, Kim, we need or what?
Absolutely. For sure. Yes.
So, Lindsay, thank you for taking the time to talk with us again and to teach us. We are ready to soak in the knowledge.
Yes, we are.
Happy to be here again.
Thank you.
All right.
Lindsay, I have a question. I want to start off. What's the difference between a tantrum and a meltdown?
And that's a great way to start, actually. So, when we're talking about meltdowns, remember that a tantrum is something really you can determine when it's a tantrum if you give the kid the thing and the behavior goes away, right? Okay. Meltdowns are very different. So I think it's easiest to go over what meltdowns are not first, because there's a lot of misconceptions around meltdowns and tantrums. So meltdowns are not just a tantrum, right? Mm-hmm. They're not a personal choice. I work with adults who have meltdowns, and they're definitely not a choice. They're not easy for a neurodivergent person to get over. They're not attention seeking. One of those behaviorist functions of behavior, they are never attention seeking. And in fact, when a neurodivergent kid is having a meltdown, they usually don't want attention. Mm-hmm. They are not in need of isolation, CPI, or other interventions. These interventions that we commonly use in school environments actually cause traumatic stress to neurodivergent children. Yeah. They're not something that can be... Oh, go ahead.
What is CPI?
So CPI is protective holds, basically. It's crisis de-escalation. It's supposed to start with verbal de-escalation too. I'm trained in CPI as well. It's not something that I want to use and did not use for the last couple of years of my teaching career because I realized that it was causing traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. The other thing about meltdowns is they can't be stopped through behavioral conditioning. All those behavior plans that we throw at neurodivergent kids don't actually stop meltdowns, and you'll understand why after we go into them. They're also not a time that should be a teachable moment. I think a lot of adults are like, oh, let's make this a teachable moment. The natural thing is, you know, discipline, teach, and that doesn't work with meltdowns. So the things that meltdowns are, they are involuntary. They are also the result of a child who is in the red or yellow zone of their nervous system, meaning that they are in fight, flight, or shutdown. They can also be in fawn appease. I don't know if I should define those
further. Yes, please do.
Absolutely.
Okay. So fight flight is what we're familiar with, right? We're trying to fight a threat. That's what our amygdala allows us to do. This portion of our brain here in the back of our head can put us into fight flight. When we fight a threat, we are trying to fight it off, get away from it, right? Flight is running away, getting out of the space, trying to get away from the threat, right? Shutdown is when fight flight hasn't worked typically, and you'll see a kid very shut down. This can also be a fawn appease response, which means that I am giving an adult or another child or an expectation what that person wants, right? Because that gets me to be safe. Fawn appease is a safety response that is usually after shutdown in my experience. Children in particular default to fawn appease very quickly because they're very powerless. So
give us an example of what that would look like.
Yeah. So with a meltdown, this can look like a kid who is fighting adults. It can look like those kids who are responded to by administrators and crisis teams. For flight, this can look like your kid who's running out of the classroom, running out of school. Mm-hmm. For shutdown, it can be the kid who's sleeping. It can be the kid who is laying down underneath their desk. That's shutdown in the nervous system. If we see a kid doing that a lot, it's because their nervous system is experiencing shutdown. When we're getting there, we're talking about long-term negative outcomes. So we're talking about depression. We're talking about kids who are suicidal, self-harming. Like that's the result of being in shutdown for a long period of time, kids who are burnout. And then when we're talking about fawn appease, too often fawn appease in particular is confused with compliance. Many of our behavioral strategies cause a fawn appease response. For example, a lot of parental strategies that we use commonly in almost every arena cause a fawn appease response that looks like compliance, but it's not the same. So,
will you spell
compliance
that?
Is willing. Yeah. Fawn spell appease. Which one? I'm sorry. F A W N and then appease.
Oh, fawn.
Yeah.
Fawn appease. Okay, I see what you're saying. I've seen fight, flight, fawn, but fawn, appease. Okay, I see what you're saying. It's not one word. It's two things.
Yeah.
Fawn.
And this is often where we see neurodivergent kids too. This is masking behavior. I'm masking my actual needs because I've realized over time that they're probably not going to be met. Mm-hmm. And so I look very compliant, but I'm actually distressed.
And it's just easier, quote, easier just to do whatever.
Yeah, and I would say that it's safer. But when we see kids still having meltdowns, fawn appease isn't working either because they're not capable of doing it because the meltdown is involuntary. The other thing is that they're distressing for the adults around the person as well, around the child. They're intensely overwhelming for the child themselves and their sensory system. The biggest thing that I think we mess up is that they're an indicator of a child who needs help and can't. Mm-hmm. They're an indicator of a need for co-regulation, right? So that goes into meltdowns a little bit. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think one of the first things that I talk about around meltdowns is how deeply steeped in behaviorism we all are in education, in my field, in society at large.
Mm-hmm.
Behaviorism really, really hurts neurodivergent people who are having meltdowns because it makes the assumption that someone can.
Yeah, that they have the skills that if they just turn them on, then it'd be okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. So if and I it is a,
it's a theory. Yes. Yeah. And it's a theory of learning. It underlies many systems and societies and schools and our familial structures in discipline with children. And it is basically this belief that if we introduce the right conditioning and environmental stimuli, that the actions and behaviors of a child will change. We use operant conditioning, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The issue with using this for neurodivergent children or kids who are having trauma responses is that we are looking for an observable behavioral output, right? We're looking for that change that we create through conditioning, consequences, rewards, punishments. But it doesn't work with somebody who's having meltdowns. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've tried it with a neurodivergent child or a child who's been through trauma. Mm-hmm. Did it work?
No.
Not consistently, right? No. And this is the reason why, because it actually discounts nervous system needs, distress, discomfort, safety, right? Individual traits and needs, because I assume everyone will respond to the same behavioral stimulus, and that's not true. Mm-hmm. The biggest and most dangerous thing about it is that it discounts individual needs, thoughts, feelings, experience. And this is where we are leading to traumatic stress, right? It also disagrees with the idea that a neurodivergent child is the expert on themselves. Mm-hmm. So also, I would even hazard to say, has negative side effects on all children. Mm-hmm. Have you ever worked with a child who will not work for you unless you give them a reward? Mm-hmm. This is because of on-brit conditioning, because my intrinsic motivation and joy of learning is gone.
Yeah. I see this a bunch in schools. The example I give is, you know, I watched a kindergarten and they were just M&M-ing the kids to death. And I was thinking, they're, you know, in 1 month, they're not going to be able to ask the kids to do anything and them do it without getting an M&M. So it's really, we've got to be very, very reflective. If we are going to use a rewards-based system, you're going to have to think about it majorly.
Yes. And I will say, too, a really helpful book to read about this is, it's called Punished by Rewards by an author. Don't know if I'm going to butcher his name. Alfie Kohn, K-O-H-N. And it's a really, really great book if you're interested in learning more about that. So he's one of the main writers on behaviorism and why it doesn't work. So
okay. I think that would be a wonderful book study for schools to venture into.
Yeah, definitely. So should I dive into like how we safely deal with meltdowns?
Yes.
Please do. Teach us too. Okay. Well, we can start undoing behaviors. It's going to take practice for us as parents and teachers.
Definitely. And I will say the biggest part of dealing with meltdowns is really revamping the way you're looking at them, shifting that perspective, right? There's a lot of studies around if I am shifting my perspective, how different things become in the classroom, right? All educators have read those books and those research studies. And it's really important to know that I'm the first part, right? Mm-hmm. I have to view that child as not being able to without my help. Mm-hmm. So let's talk through it. So okay. The very first thing has to do with the nervous system. We talked about the nervous system a little bit last time. I actually have several things that we can attach to the podcast that might be helpful for the nervous system. I also have a nervous system chart that I made for trainings with educators that shows the green zone, the yellow zone, and the red zone. Not to be confused with some of our behavioral programs. Green meaning I can. My nervous system is in a regulated state, right? Yellow meaning I can't. I'm in fight flight. I'm in shutdown. And the red zone means I really can't. I'm in shutdown for extended periods of time, or I'm in fawn appease for extended periods of time. This is a kiddo who really needs some outside help. They need a lot more than is happening in the school environment. They usually need services. They need therapy. The family needs help. So when we get there.
Okay.
If we understand where a kid's at, then we can help them. Okay. So when they are having a meltdown, they're in, I really can't. Even if it's one instance, they're still in, I really can't. And we need to view them that way, because when we do the right things for them.
Mm. And it puts us in a better mindset.
Yes.
You know, to think that they really can't. Just a quick question for you. Do you think this is the same for adults?
Very much so. Yes.
Okay. I was thinking.
Yeah. And I say this because I've worked with so many neurodivergent adults who do have meltdowns. And when neurodivergent adults have meltdowns, people don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. It's viewed as unsafe, dangerous behavior, when really it's just somebody who's in a lot of distress and needs help. In adults in particular, though, it's very difficult. Adults do have more ability, I would say, because remember that our brain doesn't fully develop until 26 to 28. If I'm above the age of 28, I actually have more ability for my brain to deal with that meltdown, right? To regulate my nervous system. Prior to that, I might not have as much access in my frontal lobe. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It does. Okay.
This is why we see adults who are neurodivergent not having as many meltdowns. That doesn't mean that they don't. Mm-hmm. They often just have them in private. They've learned the signs of them, and they've learned how to get out of the public eye, right? Mm-hmm. So let's dive into it. The very first step of dealing with meltdowns is that I should not and cannot be dealing with a meltdown unless my nervous system is regulated first. Mm-hmm. This is the most important step. Children, especially children who have been through traumatic stress, are extremely good at reading our body. It's not about what we say. They're reading our nervous system.
They're hypervigilant.
Yes, they're hypervigilant. Yes, very mm-hmm. much so. And for neurodivergent children, they're highly sensitive. Mm-hmm. Their nervous system reads the environment. And so we really need to be completely providing that calm space. And if we can't, we need to be getting some help so that we can. Mm-hmm. I always tell teachers, you're not a superhero. None of us are. We're human beings. And if you really can't regulate, you should be able to call an administrator. You should be able to get help so that you can take a break and you can come back, especially if you're their kid's safe person, if you're their familiar person. Mm-hmm. Right? So this is where teachers need that support. They need an administrator who really doesn't mind dropping everything, no matter where they're at, and coming to that classroom and giving that teacher a 5-minute break to self-regulate. The other part of this is I should be focusing on that self-regulation in the moment. I should be taking deep breaths, should be bringing my heart rate down, sipping some cold water because it regulates the nervous system. I should be making sure my body is relaxed. And if I can't be there, I really need a break. Mm-hmm. This is the hardest part.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I would, and, you know, also administrators, this is important for you to remember when you're dealing with the hot button situation too.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when I worked in school environments, it often wasn't, it wasn't the teacher who was the source of dysregulation. It was usually either the people responding to crisis because they were typically so used to dealing with traumatically stressful situations themselves that they came in with their nervous system already dysregulated, right? Mm-hmm. Administrators also have a higher exposure to, behaviors and meltdowns and things like that, right? So realistically, they're coming in with an expectation, especially if this child's had a meltdown before, if the child has hurt them during a meltdown, mm-hmm. right? And so we have to be very aware that some of the people who are responding might actually be the dysregulating force.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to be aware of that because sometimes, let's say I'm the dysregulating force. My nervous system is always dysregulated. And so I walk into a child having a meltdown and they immediately get more dysregulated. I shouldn't be the response person.
Mm.
Right. And it's something to consider in the moment too. Usually this is the classroom teacher, actually. The classroom teacher is the person who's safest because they're mm-hmm. around the child all the time. For neurodivergent children in particular, familiarity is really important. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times the classroom teacher is the safe person, which Absolutely. Makes it even harder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the first step. And if you really can't do it, if behaviors are too unsafe, we really need to be clearing that classroom if possible. I know that's a huge disruption for the classroom, but sometimes that is what it takes. And mm-hmm. then one-on-one being that regulating force. So step one.
Okay.
The second thing is that we need to be reframing the behavior. I would actually do this in the moment when dealing with a meltdown as a teacher. I would remind myself this meltdown is not a choice. This is sensory overwhelm. Mm-hmm. I would think of it, and I definitely think of it this way now, as an all over body panic attack. That's what a meltdown is. It's my nervous system being so dysregulated that my entire nervous system is panicking.
Wow. That I'm writing that. If you hear typing, I'm typing it because I want to remember that.
This will actually be on the guide that I'm going to give you as well. So.
All right.
The other thing that I remind myself of, this is somebody who's struggling and they can't. No matter what stimulus I provide, no matter what reward I provide, no matter what punishment in the sense of negative stimulus I provide, they can't. And when I do that, I can remind myself, okay, they do need three things: compassion, my calm, and connection. Kids who are attention seeking are connection seeking.
Yes.
Okay, say it again. Compassion, my calm, and connection.
Very much.
Love it. Yes.
Yeah, those are the three things that I really need. And what this deals with attachment theory. A lot of times our kiddos who are having meltdowns in school, they are either neurodivergent and extremely overwhelmed, or they are kids who have had trauma in their life before they entered the school environment. And they're seeking connection in that environment because those adults are safer, right? And they might seek this connection in lots of different ways, especially your kids who have been through trauma. They're going to test you. They're going to say, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Over and over to the classroom teacher.
You really want to be connected with me? Does it really hold up? Yeah.
Very much. The third thing I want to do is I want to limit the external stimuli. When we're dealing with neurodivergent meltdowns in particular, this is why I say clearing the classroom rather than taking the kid out of the environment, if possible, is better. Because then I can do things like I can turn off the lights if the kid consents to that. I can offer a very quiet environment. I can offer sunglasses or a blanket to hide under. Right? I can offer all these things in a safe place where the kid is not embarrassed.
Taken out of the classroom, that's not a safe place for them anymore. We've taken them out and removed them from the one place in that school building where they feel safe. Okay, exactly. That makes sense.
Yeah. The other thing I need to limit, and this totally goes against everything we know as adults, I need to limit input. I need to limit talking. Nothing I say when someone's having a meltdown is going to help. In that moment, I might be able to say, I'm safe if I have a good relationship with that child. I cannot say that as an administrator, a counselor, or a crisis response team. I don't know that child well enough to reassure them that they're safe with me.
Oh.
Yeah. So I can, let's say I'm the classroom teacher. This child already knows they're safe with me. I have a relationship with them. Even then, I might still have to limit talking. The way this looks in the classroom is that I don't ask questions. I don't make demands. I don't ask them to calm down. I don't tell them it's okay. I don't reassure them. I don't do any of that. I just sit there and invite them into my calm silently. For neurodivergent kids in particular, talking can be extremely overwhelming.
When they're already overwhelmed.
Exactly. Yeah. And so for a lot of children who are neurodivergent, they actually have, they have neural synapse formation that's different in their brain, right? And so it might be that in the moment of meltdown, I literally can't hear what you're saying, but I know you expect me to respond. And so that feels like a demand when I see your lips moving, right? And I get very overwhelmed. So I would try to decrease everything sound and sensory wise that's going on. Okay. The other thing is I want to decrease any sources of overwhelm. This is why removing the other children is a good idea, because children will try to correct a child who's having a meltdown. It adds to the demand.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just think about parenting, or when a situation does happen in school, it is input, input, input. You know, that's all we're doing. And really, we're just exasperating the situation.
Very much so. Very much so. And that's why that's the third step. Notice that all of these first three steps, they don't involve the kid.
They're us. They don't.
And for me, I tend to kind of encourage. So I'm like, you're going to be okay. It's going to be fine. But I just need to stop. I need to breathe.
Yeah. And the other thing I would say here is it's our natural inclination to want to reassure. Mm-hmm. And so this is why it's so hard to not do that. Mm-hmm. But the issue with that is that when we reassure, we're not only reassuring them, we're also reassuring ourselves. Mm-hmm. We can do that inside our head without overwhelming them.
Yeah.
So there's three more steps to this process, but.
Okay. Oh, I'm glad to know the first three. I can't wait to hear the next three.
No, either.
The fourth thing I want to do with a neurodivergent kid or a kid who's been through trauma is I want to offer familiar calming tools. The child has to be introduced to these things when they are not having a meltdown. Mm-hmm. If I am trying to introduce things when you're having a meltdown that you have not practiced with before and you have not consented to, I'm still introducing a demand. So let's say a neurodivergent child has never used a weighted blanket before. And I'm like, oh, here's a weighted blanket. And they're like, okay, mm-hmm. that means I have to use this, I guess. I'm encouraging more fawn appease, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas if I practice these skills with them when they're calm, then I can introduce them. And I have to be ready to know that they might not consent even then. I might get that thrown at me. They might say no. They might scream at me.
Mm-hmm.
They might curl up. All of these things are lack of consent. And I go back to step one if that happens. I just invite them into my calm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The fifth thing is that I want to collaborate with them if they're ready. This can involve just listening to their ideas and feelings. If they're speaking, if they're non-speaking, this might involve just giving them space and letting them know that I'm going to respect their space. This is why CPI doesn't work and it causes traumatic stress. So the other thing is I can let them know that I notice how hard it is for them, right? I might mm-hmm. say like, oh, wow, this is really hard for you. I might recognize that. If they say to me like, you don't know anything, I shouldn't be recognizing it. They're still too dysregulated, mm-hmm. right? Afterwards, I can let them know that I care for them. I can welcome them back when they're ready to return, right? So for example, they might calm down. They might take a drink of water. I might ask them like, hey, are you ready to come back? We'd really like to, you know, have everybody come back into this environment and welcome you back into our classroom, right? For younger kids, this is the last step. A lot of adults don't like this.
No.
Because when I'm operating from a you can perspective, I think that I should do something about it. Because I'm like, oh, if I provide you with the right conditions, this won't happen mm-hmm. again.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because we like to control everything.
Yes, very much. Exactly. Yes. It's a good observation.
Yeah.
And so I would say with younger kids, you're actually introducing shame before they're developmentally ready when you make it a teachable moment. Yeah.
Mm.
So the sixth step, if the child is developmentally ready, I honestly would not introduce this step unless the child showed that they were ready for it. If I have a kindergartner who is demonstrating that they are ready to do this, some kids developmentally are. The majority of children are not. I might empower them for the future, only when they're calm, right? If they're developmentally ready to do so. If they tell me, no, I don't want to talk about it, I'm going to respect that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say, oh, okay, that's fine. If you do want to talk about it, I'm here, right? But we really don't have to if you don't want to. We can move forward.
Mm-hmm.
This is really hard because we want to equip them and empower them, but they literally might not be ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
This is particularly true with children who experience traumatic stress. They already have so much shame in their system that even talking about what just happened is it's too stressful for them.
Yeah. And I don't think we ever let situations go in schools. There's always a point where we're talking about it. Mm-hmm. Yes. I know I'm guilty of that. I may wait, you know, until, well, I usually do wait till it's, they've regulated themselves and back, but I'm always circling back to the situation and trying to teach upon it.
Mm-hmm. And I will 100% own this. When I was a teacher, I was the guiltiest of this because I worked in a behavior setting. And so in a behavior setting, you're highly encouraged to use behaviorism. You're highly encouraged to use things that change behavior, right? And what I realized is that it wasn't changing anything. Mm. And I started using an approach of collaboration, and that was a little bit better. But for neurodivergent children, they literally aren't ready sometimes. And that's okay. The other thing that I can do, let's say they are ready. They demonstrate they're ready. They're able to communicate about it. They can tell me what upset them, what led up to it, how it felt in their body, how they're feeling, right? That indicates readiness. And I'm going to go ahead and help them identify those emotions. I'm going to help them identify their sensory needs, right? And their triggers. And then I'm going to introduce self-advocacy phrases. I'm not going to tell them what to do. Okay. I might say things like, oh, you didn't like how bright the lights were, and you identified that as a trigger. So next time you could say, I feel uncomfortable when the lights are this bright. I need sunglasses. I need a blanket. I need a break, right? And I'm teaching them that self-advocacy language. I'm not shaming them over what they should have done.
Mm-hmm.
I'm preparing them for the future.
Yeah, because right? If they'd known what to do, they would have done it in the first place, but they didn't know. So they don't need to feel bad because they didn't know something or weren't equipped to deal with it. Yeah.
The other thing that's really important to talk about is fluctuating capacity. Let's say the kid does show they're ready. They might be ready one day and not ready the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Neurodivergent children and adults in particular go through cycles of burnout. It's really important to understand fluctuating capacity. So fluctuating capacity means how much access to resources do I have? So I'm going to describe this for an adult. Okay. So for an adult, I might wake up one day, I've got plenty of serotonin. I've got plenty of happy feel-good chemicals. My cortisol is low because I haven't had a stressful morning. And I am well-resourced. I've had breakfast. I've had enough sleep, right? And this is an awesome day for me as a neurodivergent person, right? I'm going to get all the things done. I'm going to be the top performer because my brain has the capacity to do that. And mm-hmm. I am going to be awesome. I'm going to be a rock star. I'm going to come in the next day to work and I'm not going to be well-resourced because maybe I used up all of my dopamine. Maybe I didn't get to eat. Maybe I didn't get enough sleep. Maybe something's going on in my outside life. And so I don't even want to come to work that day. It's a miracle that I'm there. This is fluctuating capacity. And it's really, really, really confusing for adults who are working with neurodivergent children, because you might see a kid demonstrate a skill 150% one day. Like they do it better than everyone else. Mm-hmm. Because their neurodivergent brain is capable of that. Neurodivergent brains have a lot of capacity. And then the next day, they don't remember. They can't. Mm-hmm. Their nervous system isn't well regulated enough. And this is where we get into thinking they can.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then we think it's a choice because they did it. So this is a choice. And it's not, we don't realize that this waxes and wanes a little bit. Yeah.
And I would expect this with a neurodivergent child. And on a day where they can't, I might provide lots of sensory regulation tools. I might say, okay, you can't do multiplication today. Cool. Would you like to go over to this sensory place that I have in my classroom? It's totally okay if you can't do it today. Because they're still there. They're mm-hmm. still learning. Even when they're working on regulating their nervous system, being in the environment allows them to learn.
Okay, so help me with this. I use the analogy many times of a 4-burner stove. You know, the main things you're cooking that you need to attend to are on the front burners, and the things that you know are okay, you push them to the back burners. And so learning wise, like a kindergartner making a bee is on their front burner because it's so hard and they've got to, you know, they've got to think about all these things. But by the time they're in first and second grade, it's moved back to the back burner. So it doesn't need my attention. And so a lot of times when I'll work with teachers and like they'll say, oh, they knew it yesterday, but they don't know it today. And I'm like, well, it's not ready to move it to the back burner. You know, they don't really own it. They don't really know it. Would you say that's the same with fluctuating capacity? Yeah. Okay. I was thinking when you gave the example of being sleepy and that stuff, it's just like, you can't today. You might be able to another day.
Yeah, the other thing that's really important when we're talking about children who are autistic and definitely autistic children, there's skill regression, right? It's a very real thing when you're autistic. Autistic brains are absolutely great at trimming things we don't need.
Mm.
And so it might be that I can do multiplication 1 week and I come in the next week. I don't know why multiplication is the skill I'm picking. I come in the next week and I don't remember any of my times tables, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I've had skill regression. We will actually see this in adults too. I've seen it a lot in adolescents where I think they have a skill because they've demonstrated it. And then they have a skill regression and they kind of have to relearn it. The cool thing about autistic brains in particular is that they do actually form neural synapses very quickly when they're focused on a skill, right?
Okay.
And this is where we get into, is their brain interested in that skill? Did it trim those neural pathways for a reason? And we really need to consider skill regression as well. So it's hard. This is particularly hard with meltdowns and those traditional, like we label them acting out behaviors in school, right? Mm-hmm. Because we might have a kid who doesn't have a meltdown for an entire school year. And then the next school year, teacher changes, lack of familiarity. I have to relearn the entire environment. I have to learn how to mask in that environment. And I'm having, you know, 10 meltdowns in the first 6 weeks.
Mm.
And everyone's confused because they don't know what happened. They're like, you had this skill. What happened?
But it's overload. I mean, it's major overload at the beginning of the year because there's no safe. They don't know the room. They don't know the teacher. They don't know their class.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you think children who have this neurodivergent children in particular, do you think it would be beneficial to them to come up and spend some time in that classroom way before school starts with that teacher, getting to know her or him one-on-one time, talking with the teacher about how do you like these lights? What works best for you? Where would you like to sit? Where do you think you'd feel comfortable?
100%. I actually highly recommend that parents pursue that in the school environment. When the teachers are back in, they're doing PD, they're setting up their classrooms, call the school.
Yeah.
For your child to meet
with the child and a parent.
Mm-hmm.
Say, start July. He can help me set up my classroom. He can show me where we should put his desk. That's what I would do. But
I love
that. I just think that relationship, you know, that's what they need to they can't meet you and automatically adjust in a day.
No. Or come on open house night when there's 500 people in the building.
And you as a teacher are not regulated because it is so stressful.
It's so stressful. Yes.
Yeah.
That is
the other thing. Yeah, I would highly recommend that we don't actually do open house for a neurodivergent child because they are kind of madhouses. They're a sensory nightmare. I don't like going to them as a
sensory
nightmare. Our local schools have started, I think it's just in K and one, but it's by appointment and it's individual. And I just love that so much.
Me too.
I actually really loved that when I worked in Cabot as well. I really loved the fact that they scheduled parent-teacher conferences like that, and they scheduled open house and sort of, they did a great job with that.
Yeah. So. That's not good for any kids to go into that madhouse.
No, it isn't. And you get there, and the person that's going to be with you all year is nervous because everybody's – I mean, I'm ADHD, like – here, my son-in-law said, here's ADHD and here's your mom. And that's in that environment, I get so anxious. And I know the other kids can sense it. And if students are hypervigilant already, that's going to be what they pick up.
Bad read of the first time that they need to.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing that happens for neurodivergent kids too, is if they're meeting you in a dysregulated nervous system, that might be how they think it's going to be. Right. Mm-hmm. And that makes it really difficult for them to come to that first day of school because they've already been in an environment that's very dysregulating. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're thinking about on that first day of school. They're thinking like, oh, I have to go back into that. And I can see how overwhelming it is. And it was overwhelming then. And that's when we start to see meltdowns on the way into school. Right. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I would suggest for neurodivergent kids is that we have it written into IEPs that they actually either come to school 10 minutes early or 10 minutes late instead of being caught in that crowd. If that is a trigger for them, this could be children who have been through trauma too. It's overwhelming in the morning in a lot of schools, especially when we get up to the upper grades.
Oh yeah. Everybody has changed, you know, moving around. So.
I worked in several schools where they play music as the kids are coming in, which is fun. The majority of kids are going to be great with that, but not every child can handle whatever the music is, you know, that as they're coming in. That's a big thing around here. And I think that's great for the kids who can handle it. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking about the kids, my grandson, sensory overload. I mean, it would really, really be a trigger for him, I think.
I have a baby niece who is just as cute as she can be. And she just turned 6 months old. And she came to church with us and I was holding her. And it really made me step back and think about how overstimulating church was. Because she was so tired and I was trying to get her to go to sleep and she would fall asleep and 20 seconds later she'd like her eyes would open wide and I was thinking, I've never even thought about all the stimulation that is going on. So that may be teachers and administrators to really step back and try to view it, you know, and think about what all am I seeing, feeling, hearing, all the senses, and how can I make that better? Because that's not just going to make it better for the neurodivergent kids. It's going to make it better for everybody. If you're walking into Stimulation City, we're getting everybody going. You know, that's something to really consider.
And then we want them to calm down and listen. Listen.
Yeah.
We're dancing in, but now we're
going to... Right. The other thing I would say, too, is we need to understand that learning readiness for neurodivergent children can actually look very different. There are kids who are, they're sensory seeking instead of, you know, trying to get rid of sensory. They might need a kid who needs sensory. They might be a kid who needs sensory, right? So, for example, when a kid is in that green zone of their nervous system, that ready to learn, I can, right? We might see a neurodivergent kid with no eye contact, who's stimming, who's moving their body, who's fidgeting with something, and that is their ready to learn. That's when they can learn the most.
Mm-hmm.
Their brain is open, right? I mean, I as an ADHDer, I do so much better when I'm moving. I actually have a stand-up desk that you see me at. And most of the time I don't sit on the stool I'm sitting on now. I am usually up and moving because that works better for my body. I can listen better to clients when I am standing. And I think it's really important to consider that when they're engaged in learning, it looks very different from other kids. So for some neurodivergent children, so for example, I homeschool a neurodivergent child who is an autistic ADHDer, and learning for this kiddo looks like bouncing on a trampoline or wrapped in a blanket.
Yeah.
That's how they're ready to learn. So that's very different than the way they would be expected to present in a classroom, right?
Well, I have students who have to stand. They'll stand and say, can I stand at my desk? It's distracting to me. I'm the adult. I can do it. They need to stand up. It's not easy as a teacher.
I think if this is challenging for you to think about, you can think about what do you need to study. And a lot of times people need music on to study, or they need their Like, I have to have my kitchen counter clean for me to do really anything in life. You know, like, it's there are things that we do that we don't really even think about that really is the same concept for kids. It just looks different.
Yeah.
So
I would also say, too, one thing to think about is that as adults, we naturally accommodate for ourselves and nobody tells us we can't. Mm-hmm. That's not the case for children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we stop that, put that up or whatever, when that was my accommodation.
Yeah. The other thing to consider too, many times kids are trying to meet their unique sensory needs. A good example of this, I have worked with neurodivergent children who crouch on their seat with on their feet, right? And they're like this on top of their knees, right? Like they have their elbows on their knees and their feet are the only thing on the seat. And that is how they feel good. They feel very grounded like that. They feel ready to learn. But in most classrooms, they aren't allowed to meet that unique sensory need. They're told to sit down. They're told it's unsafe. I've also, my own child will stand on a chair when we're learning. and in a classroom, this is considered very unsafe. It's considered a liability, right? But this is also a kid who is advocating for their own needs behaviorally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
I love that language of ready to learn. You know, I think that can be a beautiful conversation we can have at the beginning of the year, or if we're making these changes in the middle of the year, you know, just mm-hmm. consider what we need to do to be ready to learn. And when kids throw that, well, that's not fair that she gets to do that, or, you know, well, her ready to learn is different than your ready to learn. And you just, I think that's beautiful to build empathy and to build, you know, just good skills in their brains.
The other thing I would love to see, speaking of that, we highlight learning differences, right? When we say, well, that's their ready to learn. Instead, we could say, oh, your body needs that too. Awesome. Why don't you go ahead and do that?
Do you think that would help you learn?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That might mean that we have an entire classroom who is affirming a neurodivergent child by trying their accommodation. Mm-hmm. And that's so cool. Mm-hmm. That makes that kid feel so welcome, right?
Yeah. That your statement about, us doing something that we don't even realize that would create shame. There's a lot of what we're saying and doing that may create feelings that really needs to be thought about.
Yeah. That's the other thing with meltdowns too. I think a lot of times adults don't realize that during a meltdown with a child, they're actually invalidating them. So for example, if a kid is responding to a threat in their environment and I tell them it's okay, I'm actually wrong. I just invalidated their state, right? Because it's not okay for them. Mm-hmm. It's not safe for them. And even if they can't tell me what's unsafe, their nervous system is telling me that they feel unsafe. And I need to say, oh, you feel unsafe. That's okay. How can I help?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, again, you've got my brain going.
Mine is spinning.
Yeah. And I'd actually like to offer some resources around this too. I'll send a nervous system chart. I have some slides from a training I did around these different zones of the nervous system and how you can tell a neurodivergent child is ready to learn. Also some considerations around behaviorism and how it impacts kids, maybe some resources around that too. And then I have a handout that I actually created for educators here that I did a training with that deals specifically with the steps to deal with meltdowns. So I'm happy to share that as well too, if it helps somebody. Mm-hmm. And realistically, my goal with this type of work is that I would love to see every neurodivergent person affirmed in every environment. Mm-hmm. And for children in particular, this is about their long-term outcomes. The long-term outcomes for neurodivergent people and children who have been through complex trauma are not good. The suicide rate is astronomically high with autistic children. And so one of the things that we need to look at is these long-term outcomes are not matching the interventions we're using, because we're using these interventions in an attempt to help them. But when we look at the long-term outcomes, they're not helping them. Mm-hmm. So just something to consider.
Yeah. Well, when you, we want to include your contact information because there may be people who want to reach out to you for support and advice or therapy. Mm-hmm. And you're such a valuable resource. We're so thankful to have you and get learn from you on our podcast and share. It means a lot because I think for me, particularly for my students that I teach, I need to know this as a teacher. All teachers do because those are our students. But I have a lot of neurodivergent students, and I think it's important. And I don't think I'm sitting here listening and I'm thinking, oh gosh, all the things I've done are wrong. I did it wrong. And I don't want to cause a child to feel shame. Mm-hmm. And, I want to validate them and empower them. And you've helped us so much.
I want to say something too. Yeah, go ahead, Laura. Sorry.
No, you go ahead because I'm going to remember mine. So,
okay. So I wanted to say too, like, I really appreciate you saying that, but I always tell people you already have a rich source of information in front of you, and that is the neurodivergent person. Mm-hmm. Talk with them. Listen to them, because realistically, I can come to the table with tons of knowledge around this. And I like I said, I appreciate you saying that, but I might meet somebody who all my knowledge doesn't apply to. And I really need to listen to them because they are the expert on themselves. Mm-hmm. And children are the experts on themselves. They can tell you things that you wouldn't have considered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then how validating when they see you implementing a suggestion that they gave you or an idea. I think that would be so nice.
And if you're familiar with Dr. Ross Green's work, this is what it operates around. The child is the expert, right? Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. This,
I know.
Thinking about behaviorism and how ingrained it is, I just think about like the justice system. Lots of things we have going on in our world are founded upon it. And it really is something to consider. How we can approach things differently.
Yeah. Hopefully that'll invite a world change. I would love to see a world change where behavior is not the foundation.
So. Wouldn't it be beautiful? Yeah. I just think about, at its core, if we could just get that going on with parenting, how different things could be. So, okay. Well, I want to read Punished by Rewards.
Yeah, definitely. And I would say too, we've actually seen this movement in parenting. I think it's the reason that a lot of school behaviorism is not working for many children anymore, because there is a huge shift in parenting, the whole gentle, responsive parenting movement, right? We have parents who are shifting to affirming their children, affirming their developmental stage, looking at the way their nervous system is operating. And that's very different than behaviorism, right?
Yeah.
So, and I won't say parenting is changing overall, but I have seen some shifts in that because I work with parents and children a lot that I'm just amazed by. Mm-hmm. So.
And I think of.
Yeah, I see that too. I'm a grandmother and I see it with my daughter-in-law, the way she is with my grandson, just, she uses empathy with him. You know, I know you want that, but we can't have that right now. You can have this. And just a really kind soul anyway. And she's a teacher, so that's how she is in the classroom. And I see it with my daughter. I'm this whole different approach, which I think is so much better.
Yeah.
I know, it makes me happy. My grandchildren are in good hands. Yeah.
I have a very strong relationship with my 14-year-old, and I was talking to him the other day and I said, you know, I think it's something that we need to think about because a lot of teenagers really, you know, in the teenage years, things get rough between parents and kids. And, you know, I want you to know how much I love you and how much I don't want that. And so we were kind of talking and he was like, oh, it won't happen. And I was like, we have to prepare for it, you know? And So I just mentioned, I was like, you know, I think a number one thing is communication that we need to be doing. And just, you know, it's almost like I'm trying to invite him to the table to address the situation that I know is going to come. And that just, I don't, I mean, I guess it was just a gift from God to talk about that. That came to my mind. But
that will work though, Laura, because that's kind of how I did it with, you know, my relationship with my kids and especially my boys. I thought it, you know, with a daughter, it's just going to come naturally. It doesn't. But with boys, I thought I really had to work with it. And they just told me a lot of things I really didn't want to know. they overshared a little bit. We've always had a really close relationship, and I think you're doing the right thing. I think you just have those conversations with your kids.
I think it goes back to what Lindsay was saying, is asking the kid, talking to the expert, you know. And I think sometimes as parents, we are much more experienced, but we do need to ask the expert who is dealing with all these situations about their input.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's different now. No matter what we think, it's different now.
Yeah.
The other thing too, I would encourage parents, teachers, adults in general to think about is just respecting the autonomy of children, respecting their developmental stage. Teenagers in particular are actually supposed to identify with their peers and pull away from adults. Mm-hmm. I always tell parents, if you haven't gotten in your work by 13, we're in trouble.
Yeah.
Because your kid is now identifying with their peers, mm-hmm. and you are no longer an expert in their world.
No.
So,
but with adult children, they do kind of come back.
They do. Yes.
Back home. Yeah.
But that also takes us respecting their autonomy during their adolescent years, mm-hmm. right? Like keeping them safe, having that safe foundation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And all kids really, because when we respect their autonomy and their developmental level, they want to come back. Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true. Well, I hope you do that. Is there a resource like on the internet or something that parents can dig into that development and things that, do you have an idea for this on that?
Definitely. I can actually send you a book list for this that you can include in the podcast if you want. If parents want to start somewhere, highly, highly encourage them to start with Raising Human Beings by Dr. Ross Green. That is a parenting book. That is not an education book. It's an excellent one. The other thing is Mona Delahook's work, if you're familiar with her. Amazing, amazing work for parents. Literally any book she's ever written would be fine.
Did you say Mona?
Mona, M-O-N-A, and then Delahook, D-E-L-A-H-O-O-K-E. Excellent author who has done so much work around helping parents affirm nervous system state, developmental level. It really helps parents recognize that, you know, a two-year-old can't do this, and a five-year-old can't do this, and a teenager can't do this, right? And create an attachment, like a really strong attachment between parent and child. So any of her work is fantastic. So, and obviously TikTok's got it own. Just going to say that there's a lot of people putting out information there about parenting that is, I'm really happy to see. I know we talk about how teenagers shouldn't be on TikTok, but that source of information is amazing to me.
Yeah. Do you hear your baby crying in my background?
No.
There's a little baby spending the night with us tonight. Our 3-month-old grandson. He's here.
I think. Yeah. So the internet or the Instagram account, the NeuroWild account that you shared.
Yes.
Everything. I went back and looked. I'm like, oh my goodness, everything. Oh, I thought of one thing that I was thinking earlier. Adam Grant, he's written quite a few books and is a massive researcher. I saw something that he posted this week, and it said he has a little graphic that was great. But it shared, you know, you can't control your reaction, but you can control your response. And I was thinking we really need to think about that, you know, because your jaw might drop, your face might light up or tense, but then it's what are we going to do after that reaction that's really going to set the tone for safety and connection.
Yeah. And I would also, too, in that vein, I love that saying, we're going to have reactions. We're human beings as adults, and we need to give ourselves humanity. The best thing to do with a kid when you have a reaction, or really any human being when you have a reaction, is to own it. Mm-hmm. Own it with accountability and say, hey, like, I was a little shocked when you kicked me. I'm going to recognize that hurt, right? Yeah, and it's okay to own that and to say, I really need you to not do that again, and set safe boundaries around it. That creates that safe framework, right? Where a kid knows that we love them, but that we also don't want them kicking us, right?
Right. That's true. My grandson told my daughter, I really want to hit you right now, mommy. And she said, well, I know you do. I know you're upset. And I'm sorry, but I can't let you do that because it's unsafe. I mean, he spoke it so clearly. I really want to hit you right now, mommy.
Oh, goodness. Oh, Lindsay, thank you so much for spending time with us. And today, just... I mean,
Laura and I just want to come down and spend the weekend with you and just.
We just can spend do some that. Time.
Can we do that? I have lots of airline miles.
As long as my 9-year-old would allow that.
Okay.
We could read Ross Green together and just share out quotes.
We could.
Oh, in my. Writing a book, and in one of my chapters, like, it has Ross Green all over it, and I'm like, I'm sorry, but this is the best stuff I've got. I'm going to quote him. All right, listeners, we hope that your brain is going, and that you will not let it stop. You know, let's really think about how we can start the shift or continue the shift of approaching everyone, not just our students, but everyone with this mindset. I'm excited about learning more. So thank you so much, Lindsay. Please, listeners, yes. This is the one that the baseball coaches need and the church leaders and everybody else needs. So share That's it, right. people.
Share it with everybody. Be sure to download it. Like us on social media. We want to know where you are, and it helps when you download. And thank you for listening.
Absolutely. Thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Have a great week.